Mallory rises and turns down the television. Shannon? Quietly, Gabriel Towns is discussing a beheading in Toledo. It's less than 80 miles from where Mallory watches. Shannon! What are you doing up there? There is no answer. Towns speaks quietly on the television. There are no accompanying graphics, no music, no inserts. Mallory, standing in the center of the room, is looking toward the ceiling. She turns the volume of the television even lower, then turns the radio off, then walks toward the stairs. At the railing, she slowly looks up to the carpeted landing. The lights are off, but a thin ray of what looks like sunshine sprays upon the wall. Placing her hand on the wood, Mallory steps onto the carpet. She looks over her shoulder to the front door and imagines an amalgamation of every report she's heard. She takes the stairs. Shannon? She is at the top now, trembling. Stepping down the hall, she sees sunlight coming from Shannon's bedroom. Slowly, she comes to the open door and looks inside. A corner of the window is exposed. A part of the blanket, having come loose, hangs. Mallory quickly looks away. There is a stillness and a faint hum from the television below. Shannon? Down the hall, the bathroom door is open. The light is on. Mallory walks toward it. Once there, she holds her breath, then turns to look. Shannon is on the floor, facing the ceiling. A pair of scissors sticks out of her chest. Blood surrounds her, pooling into the tiles on the floor. It seems like more blood than her body could hold. Mallory screams, clutching the doorframe, and slides to the ground, wailing. The harsh light of the bathroom exposes every detail. The stillness of her sister's eyes. The way Shannon's shirt sinks into her chest with the scissor blades. Mallory crawls to the bathtub and throws up. Her sister's blood sticks to her. She tries to wake Shannon, but she knows this will not happen. Mallory stands, speaking to Shannon, telling her she is going to get help. Wiping blood from her hands, Mallory rushes downstairs and finds her phone on the couch. She calls the police. No answer. She calls again. No answer. Then she calls her parents. Still, no answer. She turns and runs to the front door. She must get help. Her hand clutches the doorknob, but she finds she cannot turn it. Dear God, Mallory thinks. Shannon would never do this willingly. Dear God, it's true. Something is out there. And whatever Shannon saw, it must be close to the house. A piece of wood is all that separates her from what killed her sister. What her sister saw. Beyond the wood, she hears wind. There are no other sounds. No cars, no neighbors, only stillness. She is alone. Suddenly, agonizingly, she understands that she needs someone. She needs safety. She has to figure out how to leave this house. The image of Shannon blazing in her mind, Mallory rushes into the kitchen. There, under the sink, she pulls forth a stack of newspapers. She manically rifles through them. Breathing hard, her eyes wide, she checks the back of each one. Finally, she finds it. The classified, Riverbridge. Strangers inviting strangers into their home. Mallory reads it again. Then she reads it another time. She falls to her knees, clutching the paper. Riverbridge is 20 minutes away. Shannon saw something outside, and it killed her. Mallory must get herself and her child to safety. Suddenly, her heavy breathing gives way to an endless flow of hot tears. She does not know what to do. She has never been this afraid. Everything within her feels hot, like she's burning. She cries loudly. Through wet eyes, she reads the ad again, and her tears fall upon the paper. 6. What is it, boy? Did you hear that? What? What did you hear? Speak. Listen. Mallory does. She stops paddling and she listens. There is the wind. There is the river. There is the high squawking of birds far away and the occasional shuffle of small animals in the trees. There is her own breathing and her heart pounding, too. And beyond all this noise, from somewhere inside it, comes a sound she immediately fears. Something is in the water with them. Don't speak, Mallory hisses. The children are silent. She rests the paddle handles across her bent legs and is still. Something big is in the water before them. Something that rises and splashes. Mallory, for all the work she has done protecting the children from madness, wonders if she's prepared them enough for the old realities. Like the wild animals that would reclaim a river man no longer frequents. The rowboat tips to Mallory's left. She feels the heat of something touching the steel rim where the paddle ends rest. The birds in the trees go quiet. She holds her breath, thinking of the children. What plays with the nose of their boat? Is it a creature? She thinks, hysterical. Please, no, God. Let it be an animal. Please. Mallory knows that if the children were to remove their blindfolds, if they were to scream before going mad, she still would not open her eyes. Without Mallory paddling, the rowboat moves again. She takes hold of a paddle and prepares herself to swing it. But then she hears the sound of the water splitting. The thing moves. It sounds farther away. Mallory is breathing so hard she gasps. She hears a fumbling among the branches at the bank to her left and imagines the thing has crawled onto shore. Or maybe it walked. Is a creature standing there, studying the limbs of the trees and mud at its feet? Thoughts like these remind her of Tom. Sweet Tom, who spent every hour of every day trying to figure out how to survive in this awful new world. She wishes he were here. He would know what made that sound. It's a black bear, she tells herself. The songs of the birds return. Life in the trees continues. You did well, Mallory pants. Her voice is caged with stress. She begins paddling, and soon the sound of the girl shuffling her puzzle pieces joins in with the sound of the paddles in the water. She imagines the children, blinded by their black cloths, the sun embarrassing them with visibility, drifting downstream. Her own blindfold is tight against her head, damp. It irritates the skin by her ears. Sometimes she is able to ignore this. At others, all she can think about is scratching. Despite the cold, she regularly dips her fingertips into the river and moistens the cloth where it chafes. Just above her ears, the bridge of her nose, the back of her head where the knot is. The wet cloth helps, but Mallory will never fully get used to the feel of the cloth against her face. Even her eyes, she thinks, paddling, even her eyelashes grow weary of the fabric. A black bear, she tells herself again. But she isn't so sure. Debates like these have governed every action Mallory has taken for the last 4.5 years. from the moment she decided to answer the classified in the paper and first arrived at the house in Riverbridge. Every noise she's heard since has delivered visions of things much worse than any earthly animal.
"You did a good job,"
Mallory says to the children, shaking. She means to reassure them, but her voice betrays her fear. 7. Riverbridge. Mallory has been to this area once, several years before. It was a New Year's Eve party. She hardly recalls the name of the girl who threw it. Marcy something. Maribel, maybe. Shannon knew her, and Shannon drove that night. The roads were slushy. Dirty gray banks of snow framed the side streets. People used ice from the roof for their mixed drinks. Someone got half-naked and wrote the year 2009 in the snow. Now it's summer's peak, the middle of July, and Mallory is driving, scared, alone, and grieving. The drive over is agonizing. Traveling no more than 15 miles per hour, Mallory frantically looks for street signs, for other cars. She closes her eyes, then opens them again, still driving. The roads are empty. Every home she passes has blankets or wood boards covering the windows. Storefronts are vacant. Strip mall parking lots are barren. She keeps her eyes immediately on the road ahead and drives, following the route highlighted on the map beside her. Her hands feel weak on the wheel. Her eyes ache from crying. She feels an unyielding flow of guilt for having left her sister dead on the bathroom floor of their house. She did not bury her. She just left. The hospitals didn't answer their phones. Neither did the funeral homes. Mallory covered her, partially, with a blue and yellow scarf that Shannon loved. The radio comes in and out. A man is talking about the possibility of war. If mankind bends together, he says, but then it's all static. On the side of the road, she passes an abandoned car. The doors are open. A jacket hangs from the passenger seat touching the road. Mallory quickly looks ahead again. Then she closes her eyes. Then she opens them. The radio is working. The man is still talking about war. Something moves to the right, and she sees it out of the corner of her eye. She does not look at it. She closes her right eye. Ahead, in the middle of the road, a bird lands and then takes off again. When Mallory reaches this spot, she sees the bird was interested in a dead dog. Mallory drives over it. The car bounces. She hits her head on the roof, her suitcase rattling in the back seat. She is shaking. The dog didn't just look dead, it looked bent. She closes her eyes. She opens them. A bird, maybe the same bird, caws from the sky. Mallory passes Roundtree Street, Balham Street, Horton. She knows she is close. Something darts on her left. She closes her left eye. She passes an empty mail truck and its letters are strewn on the concrete. A bird flies too low, almost hitting the windshield. She screams, closes both eyes, and opens them. When she does, she sees the street sign she is looking for. Shillingham. She turns right, braking as she rounds the corner onto Shillingham Lane. She does not need to check her map for the number 273. It has been on her mind the entire drive. Aside from a few cars parked in front of a house on the right, the street is empty. The neighborhood is ordinary, suburban. Most of the houses look the same. The lawns are overgrown. Every window is draped. In her eagerness, Mallory looks to the house where the cars are parked and knows it is the one she's looking for. She closes her eyes and slams on the brakes. Stopped and breathing hard, the faint image of the house remains in her mind. The garage is to the right. The garage door, beige, is closed. A brown shingled roof rests on white siding and bricks. The front door is a darker brown. The windows are covered. There's an attic. Steeling herself, eyes still closed, Mallory turns and grips the handle of the suitcase. The house is maybe 50 feet from where she stopped. She knows she is not close to the curb. She does not care. Attempting to calm herself, she breathes deeply, slowly. The suitcase is beside her in the passenger seat. Eyes closed, she listens. Hearing nothing outside the car, she opens the driver's side door and steps out, reaching for her things. The baby kicks. Mallory gasps, fumbling with her luggage. She almost opens her eyes to look down at her belly. Instead, she brings her hands there and rubs. "We're here," she whispers. She takes hold of the suitcase and blindly, carefully walks to the front lawn. Once she feels the grass beneath her shoes, she moves quicker, walking fast into a low bush. The needles prick her wrists and hip. She steps back, listening, and feels concrete beneath her shoes. Stepping cautiously to where she thinks the front door is, she is right. Clattering her suitcase on the porch, she feels along the brick, finding a doorbell. She rings it. At first, there is no response. There is a sinking feeling that she has reached her end. Has she driven this far, braved this world for nothing? She rings the bell again. Then again. Again. There is no response. She knocks, frantically beating the door. Nobody calls to her. Then she hears muffled voices from within. "Oh my God, someone's here. Someone's home. Hello?" she calls quietly. The sound of her own voice on the empty street scares her. "Hello? I read the ad in the paper." Silence. Mallory waits, listening. Then someone calls to her.
"Who are you?" a man says. "Where are you from?"
Mallory feels relief, hope. She feels like crying. "My name is Mallory. I've driven from Westcourt." There is a pause. Then,
"Are your eyes closed?"
It is a different man's voice. "Yes, my eyes are closed."
"Have they been closed for a long time?"
"Just let me in," she thinks. "Let me in." "No," she answers. "Or, yes. I've driven from Westcourt. I closed them as much as I could."
She hears low voices. Some are angry.
The people are debating whether or not to let her in. "I haven't seen anything," she calls. "I swear, I'm safe. My eyes are closed. Please, I read the ad in the paper."
"Keep them closed," a man finally says. "We're opening the door. When we do, come inside as quickly as you can. Okay?"
"Okay. Yes. Okay." She waits. The air is still, calm. Nothing happens. Then she hears the click of the door. She steps forward quickly. Hands reach out and pull her in. The door slams shut behind her. "Now wait," a woman says. "We need to feel around. We need to know you've come in alone." Mallory stands with her eyes closed and listens,
It sounds like they are feeling along the walls with broomsticks. More than one pair of hands touch her shoulders, her neck, her legs. Someone is behind her now. She hears fingers upon the closed door.
All right, a man says. We're okay.
When Mallory opens her eyes, she sees five people standing in a line before her. Shoulder to shoulder, they fill the foyer. She stares at them. They stare at her. One of them wears a helmet of some kind. His arms are covered in what looks like cotton balls and tape. Pens, pencils, and more sharp objects project from the tape like a child's version of medieval weaponry. Two of them hold broomsticks.
Hello, this man says. My name is Tom. You understand, of course, why we answer the door like this. Anything could slip in with you.
Despite the helmet, Mallory sees Tom has blondish brown hair. His features are strong. His blue eyes flare with intelligence. He's not much taller than Mallory. Unshaven, his stubble is almost red.
I understand, Mallory says.
Westcourt, Tom says, stepping toward her. That's a real drive. What you did was extremely brave. Why don't you sit down, so we can talk about what you saw along the way?
Mallory nods, but she does not move. She is clutching her suitcase so tight that her knuckles are white and hurt. A taller, bigger man approaches her.
Here, he says. Let me take that for you.
Thank you.
My name is Jules. I've been here for 2 months. Most of us have. Tom and Don arrived a little earlier.
Jules's short, dark hair looks dirty, like he's been working outside. He appears kind. Mallory looks at the housemates from face to face. There is one woman and four men.
I'm Don, Don says. He too has dark hair, a little longer.
He wears black pants, a button-down shirt rolled up to the elbows. He looks older than Mallory, 27, 28.
You scared the hell out of us. Nobody's knocked on that door for weeks now.
I'm so sorry.
It's no worry, the fourth man says. We all did what you did. I'm Felix.
Felix looks tired. Mallory thinks he looks young, 21, 22. His long nose and bushy brown hair make him look almost cartoonish. He is tall, like Jules, but thinner.
And I'm Cheryl, the woman says, extending her hand.
Mallory shakes it. Cheryl's expression is less welcoming than Tom's and Felix's. Her brown hair hides some of her face. She is wearing a tank top. She, too, looks like she's been working.
Jules, will you help me get this thing off? Tom says.
He is trying to remove his helmet, but the makeshift body armor is getting in the way. Jules helps him. With the helmet off, Mallory gets a better look at him. His sandy blonde hair is messy above his fair face. The suggestion of freckles gives him color. His beard is barely more than stubble, but his mustache is more pronounced. His plaid button-down shirt and brown slacks remind Mallory of a teacher she once had. Seeing him for the first time, she hardly realizes he is looking at her belly.
I don't mean any offense, but are you pregnant?
Yes, she says weakly, frightened that this will be a burden.
Oh, fuck, Cheryl says. You have to be kidding me. Cheryl, Tom says, you're gonna scare her.
Look, Mallory, was it? Cheryl says. I'm not trying to come off as mean when I say this, but bringing a pregnant woman into this house is a real responsibility.
Mallory is quiet. She looks from face to face, noting the expressions they make. They seem to be studying her, deciding whether or not they are up to the task of housing someone who will eventually give birth. It suddenly strikes Mallory that she hadn't thought of it in these terms. On the drive over, she didn't think that this was where she might deliver her baby. The tears are coming. Cheryl shakes her head and, relenting, steps to her. My God, she says. Come here. I wasn't always alone, Mallory says. My sister Shannon was with me. She's dead now. I left her. She is crying now. Through her blurred vision, she sees the four men are watching her. They look compassionate. Instantly, Mallory recognizes they're all grieving in their own ways. Come on, Tom says. Let's show you the house. You can use the bedroom at the top of the stairs. I'll sleep down here. No, Mallory says. I couldn't take a room from any of you. I insist, Tom says. Cheryl sleeps at the end of the hall up there. Felix is in the room next to the one that will be yours. You're pregnant, after all. We'll help you with it the best we can. They are walking through a hall. They pass a bedroom on the left, then a bathroom. Mallory catches her reflection in the mirror and quickly looks away. On the left, she sees a kitchen. On the counter are large buckets. This, Tom says, is the living room. We hang out a lot in here. Mallory turns to see his hand is gesturing toward the larger room. There is a couch, an end table with a telephone on it, lamps, an easy chair, carpet. A calendar is drawn in what looks like marker on the wall between framed paintings. The windows are covered by hanging black blankets. Mallory looks up as a dog suddenly trots into the room. It's a border collie. The dog looks at her curiously before stepping to her feet and waiting for her to pet him.
This is Victor, Jules says. He's 6 years old now. I got him as a puppy.
Mallory pets the dog. She thinks Shannon would have liked him. Then Jules leaves the room, carrying her suitcase up a flight of carpeted stairs. Along the walls, pictures hang. Some are photos, some are art. At the top, she sees him enter a bedroom. Even from down here, she can see a blanket covers the window. Cheryl walks her to the couch. There, Mallory sits, exhausted from sadness and shock. Cheryl and Don say they will prepare some food.
Canned goods, Felix says. We went on a run the day I arrived. This was just before the first incident was reported in the Upper Peninsula. The man at the store thought we were crazy. We've got enough to last us about 3 months still. A little less than that now, Don says, vanishing into the kitchen.
Mallory wonders if he meant there were more mouths to feed because of her arrival. Then, sitting beside her on the couch, Tom asks what things she saw on the drive over. He is curious about everything. Tom is the kind of man who would use any information she gives him, and she feels like the insignificant details she remembers are no help at all. She tells him about the dead dog, the mail truck, the empty storefronts and streets, and the abandoned car with the jacket.
There are some things I'll need to tell you, Tom says. First off, this house doesn't belong to anybody here. The owner died. I'll explain that to you later. There's no internet. It's been down since we got here. We're pretty sure the people who run the cell towers have stopped going to work. Or they're dead. No mail comes anymore and no newspapers. Have you checked your cell phone lately? Ours quit working about 3 weeks ago.
But there is a landline, if you can believe the luck of that. Although I don't know who will call.
Cheryl enters the room, carrying a plate with carrots and peas. A small glass of water, too.
The landline still works, Tom says, for the same reason the lights are still on. The local power plant runs on hydroelectricity. I can't tell you if it will stop working, too, one day. But if the men working the power left the gates open in just the right way, the power could go on indefinitely. That means the river powers this house. Did you know there's a river behind us? Barring disaster, as long as it flows, we may be in luck. We might survive. Is that asking for too much? Probably. But when you go to the well out back to get some water, and it's water we use for everything, you'll be able to hear the river flowing about 80 yards behind us. There's no running water here. It gave out shortly after I arrived. To go to the bathroom, we use buckets and take turns carrying the slop buckets to the latrines. Those are just ditches we've dug in the woods. Of course, all of this has to be done blindfolded.
Jules comes downstairs. Victor, the dog, follows behind him.
You're all set, he says,
nodding at Mallory. Thank you, she says quietly. Tom points to a cardboard box on a small table against the wall.
The blindfolds are in there. You can use any of them, whenever you want to.
They are all looking at her. Cheryl is sitting on the arm of the easy chair. Dawn is standing in the entrance to the kitchen. Jules kneels by Victor at the stairs. Felix is standing by one of the blanketed windows. They've each grieved, Mallory thinks. These people have experienced terrible things like me. Mallory, drinking from the glass Cheryl has given her, turns to Tom. She cannot rid her mind of Shannon. But she tries, speaking to Tom wearily. What was the stuff I saw you wearing when I arrived?
The armor?
Yes.
I'm not sure yet,
Tom says, smiling.
I'm trying to build a suit. Something to protect more than just our eyes. We don't know what'll happen if one of those things touches us.
Mallory looks to the other housemates, then back at Tom. You guys believe that there are creatures out there?
Yes, Tom says. George, the man who owned this house, he saw one. Just before he died.
Mallory doesn't know what to say. She instinctively brings a hand to her belly.
I'm not trying to scare you, Tom says. And I'll tell you George's story soon. But the radio has been saying the same thing. I think it's a consensus now. Something living is doing this to us. And it only takes seeing one for a second. Maybe less.
Everything in the room seems to get darker for Mallory. She feels dizzy, lightheaded.
Whatever they are, Tom says. Our minds can't understand them. They're like infinity, it seems. Something too complex for us to comprehend. Do you see?
Tom's words are getting lost somehow for Mallory. Victor pants heavily at Jules's feet. Cheryl is asking if she is okay. Tom is still speaking.
Creatures, infinity, our minds have ceilings, Mallory. These things, they are beyond it, higher than it, out of reach, out of...
But here, Mallory faints. 8. Mallory wakes in her new bedroom. It is dark. For one blessed moment, the last one she experiences, Mallory wakes with the idea that all of this news about creatures and madness was only some nightmare. Foggily, she remembers Riverbridge, Tom, Victor, the drive. but none of it becomes clear until, staring at the ceiling, she realizes that she's never woken in this room before. And Shannon is still dead. Sitting up in bed slowly, she looks to the room's one window. A black blanket is nailed into the wall, keeping her safe from the outside world. Beyond her feet, there is an old vanity. Its pink color is faded, but the mirror looks clean. In it, she is paler than usual. Because of this, her black hair looks even blacker. At the base of the mirror are extra nails, screws, a hammer, and a wrench. Except for her bed, this is the extent of the furnishings. Rising, she swings her feet over the mattress's edge and sees, on the gray carpeted floor, a second black blanket, folded neatly. It is a spare, she thinks. Beside it is a small stack of books. Facing the bedroom's door, Mallory hears voices coming from downstairs. She does not know these people yet, and she can't place who is speaking unless it is Cheryl, the only woman, or Tom, whose voice will guide her for years. When she stands up, the carpet is coarse and old beneath her feet. She crosses the bedroom and peers into the hall. She feels okay. Rested. She's not dizzy anymore. Wearing the same clothes she passed out in the night before, Mallory makes her way down the stairs to the living room. Just before she reaches the wooden floor, Jules passes, carrying a pile of clothes.
"Hi," he says, nodding.
Mallory watches as he walks to the bathroom down the hall. There, she hears him dunking the clothes in a bucket of water. When she turns toward the kitchen, she sees Cheryl and Don at the sink. Mallory enters the kitchen as Don pulls a glass from a bucket. Cheryl hears her and turns around.
"You worried us last night," she said. "Are you feeling better?"
Mallory, realizing now that she fainted the night before, turns a little red.
"Yes, I'm okay. Just a lot to take in."
"It was like that for all of us," Don says. "But you'll get used to it. Soon, you'll be saying we live a life of luxury."
"Don's a cynic," Cheryl says good-naturedly.
"I'm really not," Don says. "I love it here."
Mallory jumps as Victor licks her hand. As she kneels to pet him, she hears music come from the dining room. She crosses the kitchen and peers inside. The room is empty, but the radio is on. She looks back to Cheryl and Don at the sink. Beyond them is a cellar door. Mallory is about to ask about it when she hears Felix's voice coming from the living room. He is reciting the home's address.
273 Shillingham. My name is Felix. We're looking for anyone else who is alive. Surviving.
Mallory peeks her head into the living room. Felix is using the landline.
He's calling random phone numbers.
Mallory jumps again, this time at the sound of Tom's voice, who is now peering into the living room with her.
"We don't have a phone book?" she asks.
"No, it's a constant source of frustration for me."
Felix is dialing another number. Tom, holding a piece of paper and pencil, asks,
"Want to see the cellar with me?"
Mallory follows him through the kitchen.
"Are you going to take stock?"
Don asks, as Tom opens the cellar door.
"Yeah. Let me know what the numbers are."
"Sure."
Tom enters first. Mallory follows him down wooden stairs. The floor of the cellar is made of dirt. In the darkness, she can smell and feel the earth beneath her bare feet. The room is suddenly lit as Tom pulls the string on a light bulb. Mallory is frightened by what she sees. It feels more like a warehouse than a cellar. seemingly infinite wooden shelves are stocked with canned goods. From ceiling to dirt floor, the place resembles a bunker.
George built all this, Tom says, fanning a hand toward the woodwork. He really was ahead of things.
To the left, only partially lit by the light, Mallory sees a hanging, transparent tapestry. Behind it rest a washer and a dryer.
It looks like a lot of food, Tom says, gesturing toward the cans. But it's not. And nobody worries more about how much we have left than Don.
How often do you take stock? Mallory asks.
Once a week. But sometimes, when I get restless, I'll come down and check things again the day after I already did it.
It's cool down here.
Yeah, a classic cold storage basement. It's ideal.
What happens if we run out? Tom faces her. His features are soft in the light.
Then we go get more. We raid grocery stores, other homes, whatever we can.
Right, Mallory says, nodding. While Tom marks the paper, Mallory studies the cellar. I guess this would be the safest room in the house, then, she says.
Tom pauses. He thinks about it. I don't think so. I think the attic is safer.
Why?
Did you notice the lock on the walk-in here? The door is really old. It locks, but it's delicate. It's almost as if this cellar was built first, years ago, before they decided to add a house to it. But the attic door, that bolt is incredible. If we needed to secure ourselves, if one of those things were to get into the house, I'd say the attic is where we'd want to go.
Mallory instinctively looks up. She rubs her shoulders. If we needed to secure ourselves.
Judging by how much stock we have left, Tom says, we could live another 3 to 4 months off it. That sounds like a lot of time, but it passes quickly in here. The days begin to mush together. That's why we started keeping the calendar on the wall in the living room. You know, in a way, time doesn't mean a thing anymore. But it's one of the only things we have that resembles the lives we used to live.
The passing of time?
Yeah. And what we do with it.
Mallory steps to a short wooden stool and sits. Tom is still making notes.
I'll show you all the chores when we get back upstairs, Tom says.
Then, pointing to a space between the shelves and the hanging tapestry, he says,
do you see that there?
Mallory looks, but can't tell what he means.
Come here.
Tom walks her to the wall, where some of the brick is broken. Earth shows behind it.
I can't tell if this scares me or if I like it, he says.
What do you mean?
Well, the ground is exposed. Does that mean we could start digging? Build a tunnel? A second cellar? More room? Or is it just another way to get inside?
Tom's eyes are bright and sharp in the cellar light.
The thing is, he says, if the creatures really wanted to get into our house, they'd have no problem doing it. And I guess they would have already.
Mallory stares at the open patch of dirt on the wall. She imagines crawling through tunnels, pregnant. She imagines worms. After a brief silence, she asks, what did you do before this happened?
My job? I was a teacher. 8th grade.
Mallory nods. I actually thought you looked like one.
You know what? I've heard that before. Many times. I kind of like that.
He feigns fixing the collar of his shirt.
Class, he says, today we're going to learn all about canned goods. So, everybody shut the fuck up.
Mallory laughs.
What did you do?
Tom asks. I hadn't gotten that far yet, Mallory says.
You lost your sister, huh?
Tom says gently. Yes.
I'm sorry.
Then he says,
I lost a daughter.
Oh, God, Tom. Tom pauses, as if considering whether or not to tell Mallory more. Then he does.
Robin's mother died during childbirth. It feels cruel, telling you that, given your condition. But if we're going to get to know one another, it's a story you'll need to know. Robin was a great kid, smarter than her father at 8 years old. She liked the oddest things, like the instructions for a toy more than the toy itself, the credits of a movie instead of the movie, the way something was written, an expression on my face. Once she told me I looked like the sun to her because of my hair. I asked her if I shined like the sun, and she told me, No, Daddy, you shine more like the moon when it's dark outside. When the reports came on the news and people started to take it seriously, I was the kind of father who said I wasn't going to live in fear. I tried very hard to carry on with our daily life, and I especially wanted to convey that idea to Robin. She'd heard things at school. I just didn't want her to be so afraid. But after a while, I couldn't pretend anymore. Soon the parents were taking their kids out of school. Then the school itself shut down. Temporarily. Or until they had the confidence of the community to continue providing a safe place for their children. Those were dark days, Mallory. I was a teacher too, you know? And the school I taught in shut its doors about the same time. So we suddenly had a lot of time together at home. I got to see how much she'd grown. Her mind was getting so big. Still, she was too young to understand how scary the stories were on the news. I did my best not to hide them from her, but the father and me couldn't help but change the station sometimes. The radio got to be too much for her. Robin started having nightmares. I spent a lot of time calming her down. I always felt like I was lying to her. We agreed neither of us would look out the windows anymore. We agreed she wouldn't go outside without my permission. Somehow, I had to make her believe things were safe and horribly unsafe at the same time. She started spending the night in my bed. But one morning, I woke to find she wasn't there. She'd been talking the night before about wanting things to be how they used to be. She talked of wanting her mother, whom she'd never met. It crushed me, hearing her like that, 8 years old and telling me life was unfair. When I woke and didn't find her, I told myself she was just getting used to it. This new life. But I think maybe Robin lost something of her youth the night before, as she realized, before I did, how serious it was, what was happening outside our house.
Tom pauses. He looks to the cellar floor.
I found her in the bathtub, Mallory. Floating. Her little wrists cut with the razor she'd seen me shave with 1,000 times. The water was red. The blood dripped over the tub's edge. Blood on the walls. This was a child. 8 years old. Did she look outside? Or did she just decide to do this to herself? I'll never know that answer.
Mallory reaches for Tom and holds him. But he does not cry. Instead, after a moment, he steps to the shelves and begins marking the paper. Mallory thinks of Shannon. She, too, died in the bathroom. she, too, took her own life. When Tom is finished, he asks Mallory if she's ready to go back upstairs. As he reaches for the light bulb string, he sees she is looking at the patch of open dirt along the wall.
Freaky, no?
He says.
Yeah.
Well, don't let it be. It's just one of the old world fears carrying over.
What's that?
The fear of the cellar.
Mallory nods. Then Tom pulls the string, and the light goes out. 9.
Creatures, Mallory thinks. What a cheap word.
The children are quiet and the banks are still. She can hear the paddles slicing the water. The rhythm of her rowing is in step with her heartbeat. And then it falters. When the cadence is a pose, she feels like she could die. Creatures. Mallory has never liked this word. It's out of place somehow. The things that have haunted her for more than 4 years are not creatures to her. A garden slug is a creature, a porcupine. But the things that have lurked beyond draped windows and have kept her blindfolded are not the sort that an exterminator could ever remove. Barbarian isn't right either. A barbarian is reckless. So is a brute. In the distance, a bird sings a song from high in the sky. The paddles cut the water, shifting with each row. Behemoth is unproven. They could be as small as a fingernail. Though they are early in their journey along the river, Mallory's muscles ache from rowing. Her shirt is soaked through with sweat. Her feet are cold. The blindfold continues to irritate. Demon, devil, rogue. Maybe they are all these things. Her sister died because she saw one. Her parents must have met the same fate. Imp is too kind, savage, too human. Mallory is not only afraid of the things that may wade in the river, she is also fascinated by them. Do they know what they do? Do they mean to do what they do? Right now, it feels as if the whole world is dead. It feels like the rowboat is the last remaining place where life can be found. The rest of the world fans out from the tip of the boat, an empty globe, booming and vacant with each row. If they don't know what they do, they can't be villains. The children have been quiet a long time. A second bird song comes from above. A fish splashes. Mallory has never seen this river. What does it look like? Do the trees crowd the banks? Are there houses lining its shores? They are monsters, Mallory thinks. But she knows they are more than this. They are infinity. Mommy! The boy suddenly cries. A bird of prey caws. Its echo breaks across the river.
What is it, boy?
It sounds like an engine.
What?
Mallory stops paddling. She listens closely. Far off, beyond even the river's flow, comes the sound of an engine. Mallory recognizes it immediately. It is the sound of another boat approaching. Rather than feeling excitement at the prospect of encountering another human being on this river, Mallory is afraid.
Get down, you two, she says.
She rests the paddle handles across her knees. The rowboat floats.
The boy heard it, she tells herself. The boy heard it because you raised him well, and now he hears better than he will ever see.
Breathing deep, Mallory waits. The engine grows louder. The boat is traveling upstream.
Ouch,
the boy yelps.
What is it, boy? My ear. I got hit by a tree.
Mallory thinks this is good. If a tree touched the boy, they are likely near one of the banks. Maybe, by some deserved providence, the foliage will provide cover. The other boat is much closer now. Mallory knows that if she were able to open her eyes, she could see it.
Do not take off your blindfolds,
Mallory says. And then the boat's engine is level with them. It does not pass.
Whoever it is, Mallory thinks, they can see us.
The boat's engine cuts abruptly. The air smells of gasoline. Footsteps cross what must be the deck.
Hello there,
a voice says. Mallory does not respond.
Hey there. It's okay. You can remove your blindfolds. I'm just an ordinary man.
No, you cannot, Mallory says quickly to the children.
There's nothing out here with us, miss. Take my word for it. We're all alone.
Mallory is still. Finally, feeling there is no alternative, she answers him.
How do you know?
Miss, he says, I'm looking right now. I've had my eyes open the entire trip today. Yesterday, too.
You can't just look, she says. You know that.
The stranger laughs.
Really, he says. There's nothing to be afraid of. You can trust me. It's just us two on the river. Just two ordinary people crossing paths.
No,
Mallory screams to the children. She lets go of the girl and grips the paddle handles again. The man sighs.
There's no need to live like this, miss. Consider these children. Would you rob them the chance to view a brisk, beautiful day like this?
Stay away from our boat,
Mallory says sternly. Silence. The man does not answer. Mallory braces herself. She feels trapped, vulnerable, in the rowboat against the bank, on this river, in this world. Something splashes in the water. Mallory gasps.
Miss, he says, the view is incredible. If you don't mind a little fog. When's the last time you looked outside? Has it been years? Have you seen this river? The weather? I bet you don't even remember what weather looks like.
She remembers the outside world very well. She remembers walking home as a schoolgirl through a tunnel of autumn leaves. She recalls neighboring yards, gardens, and homes. She remembers lying on the grass in her backyard with Shannon and deciding which clouds looked like which boys and girls from class.
We are keeping our blindfolds on, Mallory says.
I've given that up, miss, he says. I've moved on. Why don't you do the same?
Leave us alone now,
she commands. The man sighs again.
They can't haunt you forever, he says. They can't force you to live like this forever. You know that, miss?
Mallory puts the right paddle into a position where she believes she can push off the bank.
I ought to remove your blindfolds myself,
the man says suddenly. Mallory does not move. He sounds gruff. He sounds a little angry.
We're just two people, he continues, meeting on a river. Four, if you include the little ones. And they can't be blamed for how you're raising them. I'm the only one here with the nerve to look outside. Your worries only keep you safe long enough to worry some more.
His voice is coming from a different place now. Mallory thinks he has stepped into the front of his boat. She only wants to pass him. She just wants to get farther from the house they left this morning.
And I'll tell you what,
the man suddenly says, horribly near.
I've seen one.
Mallory grabs for the boy and pulls him by the back of his shirt.